So our path this week, spiraling through the practices of mindfulness and loving kindness, and weaving back and forth between these beautiful gestures in the world of paying attention, just the simple, clear act of giving our attention to a moment of experience. And then consciously practicing loving ourselves and others, giving our compassion to others and ourselves. And maybe it seems simple to do this, like, oh, good path, just pay attention and love everyone. And maybe you've noticed now a few days in that it's not so easy. But you're still here. And some of you who have come to many retreats keep coming back, even though you know how it is. At some point, after I had been coming on retreats for, you know, 10 or 12 years, and I was telling one of my friends, oh, retreat, it's so hard. You don't even know. All of your demons come rampaging in, and the body hurts, and the mind is yelling, and my heart is broken. And my friend, who's very practical, he said, why do you do it? I don't know. But I noticed after some years that a little while after retreat, a few months go by, I find myself looking at the schedule again. And then I'm sending in a deposit for a very long retreat because I've forgotten how hard it was. Oh, this will be good for me. I love practice. I love adore the Dharma. I love that Dharma. And then January comes. My February-March retreat is looming. Suddenly it's the end of January and I realize I have to get everything done. And then in a week I'll be up at Spirit Rock again for 2 full months of sitting and walking. Oh, I don't want to do it this time. I made the wrong choice this time. But I can't back out. It wouldn't look good. I guess I'll just have to do it. And you all know what the first 2 days are like. They're always like that. So I want to talk tonight about devotion. And included in devotion some aspects of why we keep going, how we keep going on this path. Devotion has a ring to it for some of us that's a little complicated. The Buddhist practice that we've learned and taken on in the West, it's a very crisp practice. There's no gods hanging around judging you. You judge yourself enough. You don't need a god to judge you. Right? There's no external force deciding whether you're saved or not saved. There's nothing that you need to praise or worship or do rituals toward. And this is, I think, a very good thing for many of us. I grew up Catholic, and the flavor of that kind of orienting myself toward a really big thing out there somewhere, that was hard. And it's hard for many people. That practice has its beautiful side, but it has its difficulties. And one of those difficulties is that it doesn't always feel right to set up a big little me down here, big him up there kind of duality. And then I'm always asking somebody else for grace. So I've heard from many people, many Westerners, taking up Buddhism, you know, all the Jubus, they say, the Jewish Buddhists, and the this is not such a good word, the Cathbus, you know, the Catholic Buddhists, that we've all come from these other traditions and come here. Not all of us, some of us from those kind of traditions, and this Dharma can feel like clear spring water. Oh, all you have to do is pay attention. That's all. Nothing else. There's no heaven. There's no hell. There's no big stuff. Just pay attention. And it sorts itself out. And this is true. This is what we're doing here. It's incredible. It works. But it's not easy, the unfolding of the path. And because it's not easy, there are qualities of the heart that are helpful, nourishing, sustaining as we proceed on the path. And devotion, then, is one of them. And a few aspects of devotion. Devotion, to be devoted to give myself to or dedicate myself to what I'm doing. And I want to speak to a few of these flavors or aspects of presence, ways of being present, that have been helpful to me and that are part, that maybe come under an umbrella we could call devotion. And they roughly chart an outline of the path in some linear shape, which of course isn't linear and goes around in circles. So the first quality I want to bring in is the quality of intention. And intention is deeply important on this path. It's what brought you here. Somehow you had each of us, you had an idea. Oh, this will be good. This might be good. I want to work on something, or I want to experience something. Something brought you. You had an intention toward your own healing or well-being in some way. And then you did as I also did. You sent in your deposit, and here you are. You might think all sorts of things about being here now. But again, you're still here, and it's your intention toward that healing, that well-being, that's keeping you here, even through difficulty. The Buddha described the path of practice as having eight limbs, or an eightfold path. And at the beginning of that path, the second of the wisdom aspects of the path is wise intention. And there's a Tibetan saying, often quoted, everything rests on the tip of intention. The first night we were here, I said this little poem from Ryokan. If you point your cart north when you want to go south, how will you ever get there? And also, that's also intention, pointing the cart. When the Buddha describes intention, he describes it in relation to three particular turnings of the mind or flavors. He describes the intention of renunciation, the intention toward goodwill, and the intention toward harmlessness. Renunciation is another one of those complicated words that we might have baggage with. But if we call it letting go, maybe it's a little easier. It takes intention to let go. The habit of grasping to the things we like and pushing away the things we don't like and spacing out is really strong. And to undo a habit takes some charge in the mind, takes some little bit of fire, and that fire comes from our intention. So at the beginning of a sitting, I'll generate the intention sometimes. May I be as mindful as I can, noticing thoughts when they arise and coming back to the breath. Or whatever the main practice I'm doing is. Right at the beginning of a sitting, when I set myself up and I come into an alert and relaxed posture, that intention is what sets me forward, kind of sets the ball rolling. And then whatever happens, happens. I get distracted, I come back, you know how it goes. But without that intention, it wouldn't happen. Right? Without the intention to come back when I wander, then it's just like ordinary wandering. We just wander. I was talking maybe yesterday to Anna Douglas, who's teaching the other retreat down the stairs. And we were talking about Zen practice. And we both studied with the same Zen teacher, Joshu Roshi. She for just a couple of retreats, and I was with him for several years. And she said, you know, we were talking about how many of us started in these fierce, you know, rigorous practices, like that kind of a samurai practice, and found our way here, which may seem fierce to you here if this is the only place you've practiced, but trust me. There are some serious samurai Zen masters out there. Watch out. She said, what brought you here? I said, you know, meditation instructions. That seems very obvious, right? It doesn't seem obvious. I did Zen for 6 years. No one ever told me what to do when my mind wandered. Really? Amazing. I was there for 6 years, you know, think not thinking. Die on the cushion. Those are the kind of instructions you would hear. And I was really trying to die on the cushion. I did my darn best. And then one day, I picked up Jack's book, A Path with Heart, and I opened it. A little chapter called Taming the Puppy. And I read, when your mind wanders, just come back to the breath. And it was like, whoa. Really? Then I was mad. I just spent 6 years learning how to really sit straight. I never had the intention to bring my mind back. No one ever suggested it would be a good idea. And maybe I'm a little thick, and some of y'all would have figured it out before me, but there you go. Tortoise. We'll get on to patience. So the intention toward letting go is the seed of letting go. The intention toward goodwill or love or metta is the seed of the heart opening. And we're doing metta twice a day formally here, and for some of us, a little bit every sitting. Now you know what that's like. You plant that seed, may I be well, may I be well. Happy, safe. May you be well, happy, safe. You just keep planting that seed. Lo and behold, people are coming into interviews saying, oh my God, I went into the dining hall and all those annoying people, I loved them so deeply. And you're like, yes, exactly. In a way, what the metta practice is a practice of intention. the third of the intentions, the intention toward harmlessness. It's a variation, in a way, of the metta, inclining the heart toward compassion and empathy, goodwill. May I not harm living beings. This intention weaves into the precepts that we took in the first day and that we'll take again as we come out of retreat that guide us in our life. So intention is a way of giving ourselves a compass in the world. And in that way, it's a security. I feel safe because I know that I'm not going to intentionally hurt another being. I'm safe from the effect of what would happen if I did that. And if I practice that, and of course I fail over and over, and I come back, same as the mind wandering, you come back. But as I practice that, then the beings around me maybe start to feel safe. So, intention then is this way to orient, is a compass. It guides us all the way. So, strange dark nights in the middle of our life of practice. And we might really feel like we don't know what to do, where to go, how to practice, how to be. I thought everything was going fine and now it's all dark. These basic root intentions, these seeds we planted, they're there for you. They'll come back. They flower. You get a tiny ray of moonlight and you see your compass. Maybe you don't see anything else, but the compass goes, go that way. Even if it's pitch black, kind of in the psyche, right, in the inner realm, you say, go that way. My compass usually says, watch out. Which is basically, you know, mindfulness. Be alert. Watch out. So, I brought a lot of poems, so I got to get to them. Here's a poem about wanting. It's a poem from Jane Hirschfield. I want to give myself utterly, as this maple that burned and burned for 3 days without stinting, and then in two more dropped off every leaf. As this lake that, no matter what comes to its green-blue depths, both takes and returns it. I want the losing it all when it rains, and I want the returning transparency. I want the place by the edge flowers where the shallow sand is deceptive, where whatever steps in must plunge, and I want that plunging. I want the ones who come in secret to drink only in early darkness, and I want the ones who are swallowed. I want the way this water sees without eyes, hears without ears, shivers without will or fear at the gentlest touch. I want the way it accepts the cold moonlight and lets it pass, the way it lets all of it pass without judgment or comment. There is a lake, Lala sang, no larger than one seed of mustard that all things return to. O heart, if you will not, cannot give me the lake, then give me that song. So, at a certain point in practice. I'd been sitting and walking for a long time. It's really boring. But I liked something about it. I kept coming back. And for many years in my practice, I had the kind of practice where not a lot of dramatic stuff happened. Not a lot of big emotional business. No bright lights, no ecstatic visions, no great depths of absorption where the self dissolved into twinkling particles. You hear about these things. But all I was doing was hearing about them. My practice was really just walking and sitting, getting comfortable with pain, watching the mind go and come back. And at some point, about 6 weeks into a 2 month retreat, it was usually about where I hit my edge. I can push steadily on for several weeks, but at some point, I can't anymore. So I reached that point of I can't anymore, and I went in to see my teacher, and I said, I can't do it anymore. I'm not getting any of the results of practice that I'm supposed to get. I'm really patient, but this is really hard. And he said, yeah. I said, I kind of feel like a failure at this thing. He said, yeah, maybe you've failed. Now what? I said, I don't know. I guess I'll just keep sitting and walking. And he's like, no. He said, you could, but maybe something else. I said, what? He said, I don't know. And then he said, here's your assignment. Go walk in the hills. I hadn't taken a walk in the hills yet in those 6 weeks. Because it's hard to walk in the hills when you're going, you know, 0.01 mile an hour. It was hard enough to get to the dining hall. I was always late. I was trying really hard, you know. He's like, go walk in the hills, normal speed, and figure out how you need to practice. Find out what you need to do. Ask whoever you need to ask. And figure out how you need to practice from here. I didn't want to do it. I was like, no, I'll just go back in the hall. I'm sure this was just a moment of doubt. I'll go back in the hall and sit ramrod straight, and I'm sure I will figure it out. But I trust my teacher. So I did it. I went walking, went up in the hills. Totally felt like a failure. I'm like, oh, I'm going for a walk. Ugh, my mind is wandering. I'm not even trying anymore. I walked and walked. And I wasn't trying to not think. I wasn't trying to restrain anything. And I found that I was humming. I was kind of singing a little. Namo Kuan Yin Bo Sa. Namo Kuan Yin Bo Sa. This old song to Kuan Yin, this bodhisattva, goddess of compassion. It's the Japanese version of this chant that I remembered long ago from Zen days. Namo Kuan Yin Bosa. Namo, I bow down. Kuan Yin, the one who hears the cries of the world. Bosa, bodhisattva. I came back. I was like, I don't know. I kind of just want to sing. And Jack says, go sing. So for the last 2 weeks of that 2 month retreat, I think Donald might have been there. I went down past the gate to not disturb anyone. I went into the little gratitude hut, beautiful little hut down there with the pictures of the teachers from our lineage. And I would go in 3 or 4 times a day whenever I felt like it and sing. And I sang to Kuan Yin, and I sang every chant that I knew of. Then I made up some new ones. Jane Hirschfield says, O heart, if you cannot, will not give me the song, if you cannot, will not give me the lake, give me the song. So word for devotion in Sanskrit is bhakti. And bhakti is this quality of being devoted, this quality of the heart that wants something so deeply. And there's a whole path of bhakti. You can say, oh, I'm practicing bhakti yoga. And it's a beautiful, there's a beautiful turning of kind of the description of the path in bhakti. In a lot of kinds of the path, we say, what I want is union. What I want is to be free. What I want is finishing. But in the bhakti path, you don't say that. Because to be finished means the story is over. Means the love affair is over somehow. What you want is to want more. To want more fiercely. The way Jack said it to me, paraphrasing Rumi, he said, you don't want to get in the room. You just want to sit outside the door, wanting to be inside, and really want it. And so this aspect of longing, then. As I started singing, I realized that I really liked the singing. And started singing to everybody, Krishna and Shiva. You know, in the yoga practice, all these gods, right? Enough of that dry, clear spring water. Let's have some gods and goddesses. And it turned out, right? Committed Vipassana yogi, committed to the clear, dry act of seeing crisply what's true. It turned out I adore singing to Hanuman, the monkey god, flying through the air. My wife, Sarah, makes fun of me. She's like, you sing to Hanuman, you just start crying every time. Like, I know. It's not that I think flying monkeys are all that, you know, special. They are, but, you know, that's not why. In the chant to Hanuman, it says, I don't know anything, so I go to you, Hanuman, son of the wind. I keep making mistakes. I keep stumbling. I actually can't do anything right, so I throw myself at your feet. And I give it up. And then very reassuringly, the chant, the Hanuman Chalisa, it says, whoever chants to Hanuman 100 times will be freed from all sorrow and gain bliss in heaven. Like, okay, I can do that. I haven't been keeping a checklist, you know, 67, 68. But I figure if I just keep doing it. Of course, those stories are always dangerous. You know, chant it 100 times and you complete liberation. Of course, that's 100 times with a clear heart. You know, and a non-distracted mind. So now I'm really not keeping score. That's why in the Tibetan practice, you know, you do your mantra 100,000 times. And just in case you missed a few out of distraction, you do an extra 10,000 on the end, just to be sure. So in that tradition, this beautiful Saint Mirabai was an upper-class woman in India, in Rajasthan, wealthy. She was arranged to be married to some rich guy. But a little bit before the marriage, she had an encounter. She says this. The Dark One threw me a glance like a dagger today. Since that moment, I'm insane. I can't find my body. The pain has gone through my arms and legs, and I can't find my mind. At least 3 of my friends are completely mad. I know the thrower of daggers well. He roves the woods. The partridge loves the moon, and the lamplight pulls in the moth. You know, for the fish, water is precious. Without it, the fish dies. If he is gone, how shall I live? I can't live without him. Go and speak to the dagger thrower. Say, Mira belongs to you. Mira says, oh, friends on this path, my eyes are no longer my eyes. A sweetness has entered through them, has pierced through to my heart. How long did I stand in the house of this body and stare at the road? My beloved is a steeped herb. He has cured me for life. Mira belongs to Giridhara, the one who lifts all. And everyone says she is mad. So she speaks to a moment where there's an experience of something that is more true than anything we've ever known before. An experience of a deep clarity, a deep knowing. And this comes on retreat. You were just standing there in the house of the body, and then suddenly a deeper love or a deeper knowing or a deeper clarity than you've ever seen before. So we long for this. It comes on its own. And like everything, it comes and goes. And when it goes, then the path of bhakti really kicks in. So, the Buddha teaches a lot about desire and the issues with desire. And we've been looking at grasping and aversion, wanting and pushing away, and the suffering that comes out of that contraction. And in the Theravada tradition, there, especially kind of in the old style, it's pretty easy to get the sense that it seems like desire is a bad thing. Like, oh, just stop desire. In that chant we've been doing every night, the sharing of blessings, may all desires and attachments quickly cease. The first time I really paid attention to that line, I was like, wait a minute, I'm not sure I want that. All desires? The desire for peace, the desire for community, the desire for justice. I don't want those desires to cease. Those desires impel skillful action in the world. I'm not ready to give up this world. So the word desire in that second noble truth way, desire being the cause of suffering, it's a little bit of a difficult translation. The word that we're translating as desire in Pali is tanha. And literally it means thirst. It means the way there's a like when you're really parched, you're dehydrated, and it's not even rational. You just gotta have it. That's a little the sense of tanha, this grasping and aversion. There's a different word in the Buddhist teachings called chanda. C-H-A-N-D-A, chanda. Less taught on, more around here, we like this word. It means skillful desire. It's the desire for that which brings happiness, that which brings release. And people sometimes ask, if desire's the cause of suffering, you know, what about wanting to be free? Wanting to be free is the cause for becoming free, actually. It's one of the causes. And as you may have noticed, practice is difficult. And it's difficult for a long time. Not to be a downer, it's also extremely joyful, and it's joyful for a long time. But it's both, and that's just true. In order to stay on the path, in order to keep going, to keep walking, you have to want something. And so chanda is some of that fire in the heart that impels us forward, that when I don't want to go to the next sit. I'm done. I just want to fall over in the grass and become an earthworm. It's Chanda that sort of chimes in and says, it's okay, just go. And kind of keeps me back in. It's like, and I go because I want something. This ties in, and I'm weaving a little nonlinear here, but it ties into, I want something, why does that mean I would come to sit? And that ties into another one of the aspects of devotion, which is faith. I need the desire, the upwelling, to keep me here. And the reason I'm going to keep coming back here is because something about this form, this practice, this teaching has entered my heart. Actually, the Dharma is the dagger. You can say the Buddha is the dagger thrower or something. I don't know where the dagger comes from. But the dagger entered my heart. And that here I am. I keep coming back. It hurts. I keep coming back. In the beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta, the scripture where mindfulness is elucidated, the Buddha, at the very beginning of the scripture, he's describing coming to sit down in meditation in a suitable place, arranging oneself for practice, all of this that we do each time we start, each time we come here. And the scripture goes, the meditator settling down, crossing legs, and then it describes three qualities of mind to bring in before you even start the practice. It says the practitioner attends ardent, fully aware, and mindful. Ardent, fully aware, and mindful. These are the background qualities that support the whole meditation practice. And then it will go on to list what we're mindful of, all the aspects of mindfulness of body and breath and feeling tone and emotions, everything we've been talking about. There's one more little quality. Ardent, fully aware and mindful, setting aside grief and distress in relation to the world. And that's beautiful. There's a little letting go also. So the one I want to talk about is ardent. At the end. Let's do questions after. Ardent in English means with passionate intent, with passionate commitment. We speak of lovers being ardent. And this is the word in the scripture. Ardent, fully aware and mindful, setting aside grief and distress. So even in this, the clarity of the mindfulness practice, so crisp, the first quality listed that we will need, it's indispensable to proceed, is a quality of passionate connection to what we're doing. So, faith. And there's a lot that can be said on faith. I want to just touch a little bit on the aspect of faith that's part of this, what keeps you going, what can keep us going on the path. Faith is another one of those charged Christian words. And it seems to imply that I have to have faith in something. Faith in God, faith in... And in a way, that duality can be useful. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is teaching Arjuna And Arjuna is asking about the different paths. The path of clear seeing and emptiness versus the path of action in the world versus the path of meditation versus the path of devotion, bhakti. And Krishna says all the paths work. But the path of emptiness, the path of absolute non-duality, is very difficult because the unmanifest is obscure and hard to see. If we were to just come here and say, all of your experiences are empty of self, all that there is transcendent oneness with no distinction at all, see yourself as completely empty in the sea of everything, what would you do with that instruction? Maybe you would see that. You would, oh my God, see that. And there's teachers that teach that way, and it's possible to receive that transmission and get it. But I never got it. I've heard that teaching from teachers who really look at you with those eyes, and they're like, it's all empty. And I'm like, okay, I'm trying, man. I'm doing my best. Oh. And I'd be like, you know what? I'm not empty yet. I'm looking around. I'm like, all the ecstatic people seem empty, but, you know, not me. So the unmanifest is obscure, difficult to attain, says Krishna. He said, so better, easier, just love me. I love the Gita. I love this teaching. Don't worry about the complicated, subtle, difficult practice. Just love me with all your heart. Dedicate all your actions to me and let go of the results. I'm like, I can almost do that. So there's a way that a skillful use of duality can actually be beneficial. In the Buddhist frame, we can talk about taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha as we did the first night. So we can remember the quality of Buddha, the quality of wakefulness. And we can remember the historical Buddha and the story of the Buddha, which is inspiring and beautiful. The stories of the different saints and lamas. The stories from our teachers. And all of that, it contains an element of I and thou, an element of subject and object, me and you, of veneration, of respecting something else. And it's useful in the same way that the metta practice is a dual practice. In the bare practice of it, may you be happy. I'm wishing you well. One of the questions this morning pointed toward that. What's with this I in there? What about no self? It turns out all of these practices that are dual in their nature, these practices of praise or worship, gratitude, taking refuge, they really work. They give the heart a direction. And at a certain point in practice, they unravel. Right? There's moments when the meditation is flowing and deep and things are dropping away, there are stages where there's no refuge. There's no Buddha. Nobody's getting anywhere. And that emptiness actually does appear. It appears as a result of sustained attention and concentration and stilling the mind and heart and opening. Faith as a quality appears in several of the old lists. It appears as the first in a list called the Five Faculties. Faith leading to energy. Faith gives me a way to orient, like the intention we were speaking of. And that orientation, like once I know where to pour myself, then my energy can assemble. Faith leads to energy. Energy sustains mindfulness. Mindfulness supports unification of mind. And wisdom grows from there. Five faculties: faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. It's in several other lists. One other that I'll just mention, just touch on, is a beautiful list that talks about how suffering can lead to faith, and faith leads to joy, and on from there into a whole list of the deepest qualities of freedom. And this list is beautiful because I think it speaks to why many of us are here. I certainly found the path because of suffering. No one would sit there in that freezing cold zendo at 2:30 in the morning, falling asleep and getting hit with that stick to wake up. You wouldn't do it unless you had a really good reason. And everyone there, their reason was because this is actually better than not doing it. That actually I have no choice but to do this. And we come here, gentler place, but you're still sitting here and it's so hard. And there's a way that the suffering in your life has led in some way, some intuition said, there's a way and I'm willing to walk it and see what happens, be brave. And that willingness is an aspect of faith. And then as we practice, as we have the experiences that come on the path, shining bright experiences of insight and pleasure, deep lows of seeing our stuff and being plunged in the muck, and the storms of the hindrances. For me, the storm of doubt maybe is the worst. But once you've been around the merry-go-round a few times, you start to notice that it keeps going up and down. This is a mixed metaphor, around, up and down. Once you've been around the Ferris wheel, you realize it keeps going up and down. And that moment where you're kind of starting to head down and then it stops, it kind of hangs there. I don't know if they have these things anymore. But, you know, and it's stuck for a while and you hear clanking down below and you sort of look out the grate and you're a long way from the ground. Once you realize that that happens pretty reliably, and then eventually it starts up again, and never does it happen that the little cage you're in, you know, plunges from the heights. It has never happened. It just sort of hangs there for a while, and you're scared. And then you have to pee, you know. And you're scared some more, and you wonder what's happening. And then you're trying to comfort the person beside you, because you don't want your girl to be scared, or you don't want her to know you're scared. So you say, oh, honey, it's okay to be. Once you've been around the Ferris wheel of practice a few times, you realize, oh, it just starts up again. Thank God. The storm passes. And that perspective starts to give you what's called confirmed faith. Confirmed faith starts to arise in practice when you've started to have some experiences that are real. You see something clearly. Some tangle in your life loosens a little bit. A little light shines through. A storm passes, and once again, there's something like peace. The first few times this happens, you don't really trust it, maybe. Maybe it was an aberration. Maybe I just, you know. Maybe I only really feel great this morning because I had a big cup of coffee and I'm high on caffeine. You know, it was the chocolate. But it wasn't the caffeine, actually. My practice was going well. And after a few times around that cycle, I start to trust. Oh, I have actually had experiences of peace. And those experiences also are seeds. Those are very deep seeds. Each time in the last few days that you've come through a storm, or somehow you've sat down, and it's that one sitting of the day, or one sitting where there's just a little clarity, there's just some ease, a little bit of light, or a lot of light, a little vibration in the belly that doesn't hurt. You see something clearly. Those experiences are are the seeds that get watered each time you pay attention, each time you send yourself some love, each time you let go of judging. And they grow. And over the years, they get stronger and stronger. So, devotion is one of the aspects of our path and practice that is really personal and unique. It's not such a technique like mindfulness or even metta, where you kind of just, you know, say the phrases and it works over time. It's part of the mandala of heart practice. But just in the way that in the metta you tinker, you find what works. What's the right phrase to light up the heart? What do you have to do to stay devoted, to stay in? I sing and read poems. I pray to the monkey god and start crying. I really love the Prajnaparamita statue down in the lower hall. And that's just me. I like deities. It works for me. It might not work for you. But each of you has something, or else you wouldn't still be here. So then the encouragement is find it, whatever it is. If it's listening to talks, if it's walking in the hills, if it's writing or somehow remembering. And find what it is that keeps you in. It keeps you in love with the practice. And then keep doing that. I'll close with one more poem of Mirabai's. Some of the best poems are the poems where she's tasted the flavor of the beloved Krishna. But then he goes, he's gone. And there's all of these separation poems. Why won't he come? I stand in the doorway all night. I'm an abandoned woman. The beloved comes and goes. And when the beloved is gone, there's the ocean of separation. And this is a sweet, poignant, kind of wrenching part of the path. And we all find it. I had that great sit and now it's gone and now I'm just hurting again. What happened? The beloved is gone. I'll read a poem where the beloved has come back, because we like to end on the happy story. Because the beloved always comes back. I promise. My beloved has come home with the rains, and the fire of longing is doused. Now is the time for singing, the time of union. At the first thunderclap, even the peacocks open their tails with pleasure and dance. Giridhara is in my courtyard, and my wandering heart has returned. Like lilies that blossom under the full moon's light, I open to him in this rain. Every pore of my body is cooled. Mira's separation and torment are over. He who comes to those who love has remembered his promise. we'll sit for just a moment and then